Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
QNL.
With guest co-hosts.
Ospina.
Quantum Tarantino.
Selassicus.
Please rate Polycast, favorably hopefully, on iTunes.
Welcome to episode 136 with Dan Q.
Rufflecopter! May all your copters be ruffled!
The Mian Team.
Will work for favorable RNG odds.
The Lassicus.
Hello, everybody.
And hopefully joining us a bit later, Quantum Tarantino. And of course, me, Ozbena. First topic, the question, what is the best way to cure sickness? Obviously talking about the end game of Civ 4, after you've built a lot of factories and coal plants, etc., you've got a lot of unhealthiness in the buildings. What would you do? The two options given in the post by Reddish Recu on the Civ Fanatics is adopt environmentalism or get recycling centers, others.
There's so many ways. The one that jumps out as the single strongest way is the one that you don't really have to do a lot of investment to do, which is to reach healthiness resources. Obviously, every city just about should have a granary, so that the priority goes to corn, rice, and wheat, because those are worth 2 health for each one you can acquire or trade, if you don't have one already, that is. And after that, I would look again for more resources. Resources are the easiest way to boost your happiness and health, and they're the least expensive way to do so, as long as you have something to trade to get them. And you usually will, unless you're just way too small for this point in the game. After that, it's a little bit more dicey, and you have to look at your options.
Once Beyond the Sword was released, it did become a late game issue that unhealthiness was a bigger problem than it was beforehand, once multipliers for coal and oil and things coming into your unhealthiness. But I mean, my first thought on it is that unhealthiness is better than unhappiness, as long as you're still growing. Then there's different late game options, because sometimes you can't just go out and get more resources or whatever, but you've still got options. The one that came to me as well, that like would usually be something that you would be considering in a late, if you're playing that late in the game, is that you have Sid Sushis or cereal mills built, and you can still have massive growth in all your cities with massive unhealthiness as well. And then later game with genetics, you know, recycling centers, et cetera, et cetera.
You do reach a point where you're comparing the benefit of building something to counter unhealthiness versus the benefit of just sucking the unhealthiness, so to speak. So, what are you willing to build? Is it worth it however many hammers it is to build the hospital instead of something else? For example, wealth to reach the next technology faster, or units, or do you not want to build that? And a lot of people on this thread give a lot of hate to environmentalism when it's actually a good option depending on your tile improvement setup. Not always a good option, certainly, but there are times when environmentalism is really a useful civic, especially when you force everyone else into it who isn't as well equipped to make that transition. For example, if your opponents are heavy leaning on workshops more heavily, then you can really hose them with environmentalism. Yeah. Absolutely. Really, any of the health options have their place. You look at, what is it going to cost me to invest in this? And then you look at what you could be doing with that cost instead of, investing in that health.
It's also dependent on what you're actually attempting in the game as well. If you're, going for domination, et cetera, you might not necessarily be too concerned about unhealthiness because you're trying to pump out units and take over the world. But if you're, say, going for space, then you obviously want to have as much production as possible, which means you want to have as many production multipliers as possible, which leads to unhealthiness. And if that causes your cities to shrink, then you've got to look at the cost of buildings to reduce the unhealthiness, or, looking at other options to stop your cities shrinking.
Yeah.
In the late game, I usually just ended up ignoring unhealthiness entirely, probably because, as you said, I normally went for a domination victory, and that sort of situation, it's usually not much of a concern. Because, I mean, it slows down city growth, but other than that, it doesn't really have any other negative side effects. Unhappiness is a much bigger concern.
Yeah, well, unhappiness yeah. sort of hinders you, you know, actively, whereas unhealthiness, you can, in a lot of cases, just deal with as though you just grow slower, which is not necessarily a problem in the game.
Hidden cost there. Because when you have, like, -6 on health or something, you are losing a lot of food in that city, and you could literally be working 3 extra tiles if you didn't have it. And if those 3 extra tiles are productive tiles, that might be costing you to not get it. But then again, if you're going domination, you're going to be capturing more and more resources anyway. And, you know, the faster you can capture the cities, usually the better that is. But I wouldn't go so far as to say it's not an active hindrance on a city. I think it's just perhaps a less of a hindrance than unhappiness in the city, because unhappiness, each point of that reduces a pop that can work immediately. It's an immediate effect. But even so, you start getting into late game unhealth things, you really are giving up a lot of production potentially by living with the unhealthiness. If it's going to take you 20 turns to get rid of the unhealthiness, and you could have built like 8 or 9 units in that city in that time period, or, you know, even just 5, you know, build 5 units in all your cities and go kill everybody and win. So there's no point in investing in the health structures at that point.
It was probably more of an issue before Beyond the Sword, but after that, you know, I just get the corporations that improve food supply, and that would more than offset unhealthiness in the very late game.
Yeah, exactly. You can just basically take all the food, you know, the seafood resources or the cereal resources and counter the unhealthiness by, you know, if you've got 6 unhealthiness, then you get 6 extra food from the resources, that, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
I would just like to point out that corporations are not the end-all be-all here. First of all, you have to research at least an extra technology, and in cereal mill's case, 2 extra technologies beyond something you would want to get them. And then you need a lot of gold to spread that to all of your cities. And,
very true.
You also have maintenance issues. And if you're not going a setup that relies a lot on wealth multipliers, or I should say gold multipliers, then you're also going to have to invest in the banks, invest in Wall Street. Corporations have a lot of setup costs. They can obviously be worth it. Some of the best games that we've ever seen have come from the use and abuse of corporations. Certainly for both Score and for Stakes. And by the way, I think the best part is Mining Inc. Because it has the fastest turnaround once you spread it to a new city in terms of how quickly it'll help you set up that city and then continue to spread it or build units or whatever.
Perhaps the shortest and most accurate response in the thread itself was from NFW to the question, which is definitely other, as opposed to responding to having industry and a lot of sickness. Moving on from Civ 4 into a Civilization 5 topic that involves a couple of polls, which of course almost automatically means it will get mentioned on the show at some point.
Yes. and these two polls are the best and worst unique abilities in Civilization 5. And Civilization 5 really does have some duds out there. There are some abilities that are just makes you wonder how the developers put them together, and other abilities that are really quite good. I think one of the tricky things with a topic like this is that an ability that's weak might be complemented by a unique unit or two or a unique building that really synergizes well together, and so the civilization as a whole might be very useful. The poll results were the best unique ability was Archimede Legacy, the Persian trait which improves Golden Ages, and the worst unique ability was, by an overwhelming margin, Barbary Corsairs, which is the Ottoman trait with sea units. I personally agree a lot with Barbary Corsairs. I think that it sort of makes sense historically, but it fits sort of strangely with the civilization, and also naval power is somewhat underwhelming. Has been in every civilization game.
Oh, man. You could go to town on this topic, which we probably will. Just to add to your actually point about a civilization's unique ability not being the be-all and end-all consideration of civilization, because you also take into account unique units and or unique buildings. Beyond the consideration of what is best and what is worst is not, of course, not only subjective, also being notably situational. I have some issues actually with the polls. maybe Phil picked up on this too as well, given his marketing background. First off, the best poll is not anonymous, whereas the worst poll is. So if you're trying to determine, okay, someone has voted for best and someone has voted for worst, I can check, okay, who has voted for best and what it is that they voted for. But I can't see worst. So even if both polls had the same number of responses, which they do not, by the way, it's harder to tell, am I really comparing everybody's opinion in both respects? The other issue, which, I mean, to me, that was an oversight, perhaps not in checking the box to make the votes public. This other DLC category.
Yes.
Let's say we are going to lump all the DLC together, which in and of itself to me is flawed, although I do understand the intention, don't get me wrong. It's further exacerbated by the fact that there is actually DLC listed individually, and that's Mongolia. And yes, it is free, but it is downloadable content. But it's listed along the other standard sieves.
And also the fact that the other category ended up being the most highly rated of best unique abilities. So it leaves you wondering, okay, which other ones? Is it like a little bit of everything, or?
Yes, exactly. It answers questions, but asks more. And certainly whenever you poll something, you're getting quantitative data. You're not getting qualitative data. You're not getting the explanation behind it. Okay, now discuss why it is that you voted this way. It's also asking questions that we shouldn't have to ask, which, like as you said, Val, is, okay, is it one DLC? Is it all of the DLCs combined? A little bit of everything? A lot of one, not the other? And I decided, okay, I'm going to do a ranking. You could probably also see this coming.
Oh, no.
But I think another thing that's important whenever we do a top list, and it's usually a top 10, but in a way this is actually a top 25 because you got 18 standard sieves plus the 7 DLC sieves released to date, is, okay, my criteria for ranking was first off single player, because I think it's fair to say that the majority of Civilization V play is single player, and we've discussed multiplayer issues many a time before. Some of which have been addressed, some of which have not. The second thing I looked at is early game and then mid-game priority. Yes, you can do a later game start, but I also think it's reasonable to say that the majority of people are starting games, if not from the ancient era, in the first half of the game most of the time. Another consideration for best ability is the versatility of gold, which we talked about already this episode in a previous topic, including the ability for golden ages. So I understand in the best poll from the standard sieves why the Persian unique ability was out in front by a considerable margin. I do get that. Speed of technological discoveries, especially early to mid-game, also important. The acquisition of culture early on, which helps give you some flexibility towards not only your preferred play style, but also your victory, your victory goals. I mean, we're assuming you are actually trying to win the game one way or the other. Speaking of which, I often play for a domination victory, so that also influenced where I ranked things. And also, I'm thinking about map types, specifically those that are, if not strictly land-based, then they're land-heavy. I think it's also important when you're ranking this to consider that you don't have any of those options enabled. Like, for example, if you disable barbarians and or city-states, that's going to radically alter what you're thinking about these abilities. And in some civilizations' case, then there is no ability, unique ability that they have in effect, which could actually make for an interesting variant. Anyone else approach trying to decide how to rank these in a similar way, like similar considerations?
I'm the opposite way. I don't go for domination too much. So a lot of those just didn't fall in. But I think everyone has to agree the extra golden ages from Persia is just game-breaking at times. It is so strong being able to have that extra gold come in, have those extra golden ages, have those longer golden ages. It by far and away is the strongest.
The criteria I generally follow for leaders are... This can apply to abilities, unique units, unique buildings, improvements, whatever. Excitement. Games are intended to be fun. So, you know, whatever it is, it should be exciting. That's one problem I have with the German trait, is that it's just a passive maintenance bonus, which is something that you don't actively really get involved in. I don't find it very exciting. Another criteria is synergy. Do the traits of a civilization work well together? Is it unique? Can we play the leader in a fundamentally different way? How realistic is the trait? Time is a big factor, as you mentioned before. Early effects are generally more enjoyable than late ones since we can use them more. And that also is persistence. Some bonuses are useful throughout the entire game, others are not. Generality, and that is like the English trait, is only useful on maps that have a significant amount of water, so it makes England somewhat less useful on Pangaea maps. And that's basically what I usually look at, is fun, synergy, uniqueness, realism, time, persistence, and generality. It also is a question of, when we're dealing with things like this, you have to separate best and worst into powerful versus fun. Because something that's really overpowered might actually make the game less fun if it's too easy, if you can just use this trait to exploit the game in a particular way. And what we're always looking for in a game is that it's fun, so it's really important that anything be enjoyable.
I like your active as opposed to passive consideration. In other words, because it's passive. By choosing this civ, I have this ability. The end. I think you mentioned Germany. Okay, so you pay 25% less for land unit maintenance. There is, with regards to Germany, there's also, upon defeating a barbarian unit inside an encampment, there's a 50% chance that you'll earn 25 gold, and they will join your side. So to me, there is the active.
Right.
The only thing that, and of course this could be a whole separate topic, the only criteria that you said that I kind of went, I don't know, was the realism one, but I think that's pretty minor in the grand scheme of things. I like the excitement one too, because that also opens up for differences in interpretation, and also even for Jade, who mentioned that he's not a domination style individual in Civ, that can also influence how it is that you're ranking it, and can open up to differences and disagreements. And of course, we all like controversy on this show. What did you hear on Polycast today? Everybody agreeing. Oh, well, there was a dogfight. Well, now, I better go download that like a dozen times. No, wait.
Is that why I'm on this show? I always did wonder.
So how did you end up ranking them?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. It was going to happen anyway, Phil.
I guess. I don't fault the questioner here, not him.
I'll preface this by saying that what I did is I did include the downloadable content civs in the ranking. And by doing that, if you think, okay, I don't have any downloadable content, or I don't have that specific downloadable content, then of course you can just say, okay, you know, then for the standard civs, then, you know, Daniel, the number that Daniel said is actually one higher for me because I don't have that particular one.
Another thing to add is, it might be, if one of the downloadable civs is really fun, that might be a good reason to get that.
Yes, exactly. Something that's interesting, something that's exciting, something that is different that you can recognize. Hey, this is substantially different. In other words, just because this civ has this unique ability doesn't necessarily mean that you can't do it with another civilization. You just have to work harder at it. But there may be times where it's like, whoa, I can't even begin to touch this civilization's ability. When I look at essentially what I consider the top half, I know we've got 25 civs, so, you know, I'm not going to treat a civ as a half of a civ. So when I look at a top 12, if I include downloadable content, four, so fully a third of the top 12 I would put in downloadable content. And I'll say right now, for what came out as the best in the poll here, the Persian unique ability, if I take into account downloadable content, I'm actually going to put Persia second. And I'm going to put Spain as number one. And that is because of the versatility of the gold. So this is seven cities of gold. So with this one, it's a gold bonus for discovering a natural wonder. So you get a gold bonus for discovering a natural wonder, period. Bonus is enhanced if you are first to discover it. That's the biggie. That's kind of like the primary reason I put that there. The culture, happiness, and tile yields from natural wonders doubled. That's nice, but this gold that you can get, especially with regards to one particular natural wonder that we've probably mentioned before, I don't know, otherwise known as El Dorado, is massive. Now, yes, I do realize that this is, you may say, now, this is situational, Dan. This is assuming that where you are able to get to a number of natural wonders, especially if you're able to get there first. But even if you don't, let's say that you never get there first. Okay, you're going to get 100 gold every single time you find a natural wonder. You take that into consideration when you think about what that gold can buy for you, regardless of your victory condition. And since I am going for domination, I often think about building, quote-unquote, say, a lower-grade unit, like a warrior, and then upgrading it to a swordsman, for example, because as we've discussed before, it's cheaper to do that than to actually buy the swordsman outright by a considerable margin. But even then, if you are lack for production and lack for science, but you realize, I've got gold, you can purchase those things. In other words, you can translate that gold into almost anything, you know, other than taking the gold and literally throwing it at people, but you can translate it into things that throw things at people, such as military units, for example. So I'm just going to mention the top three for right now. So Spain, number one, Persia, we mentioned the Golden Age. Golden Ages last 50% longer, which in and of itself, that's enough as far as I'm concerned. But then during a Golden Age, units receive plus one movement and a 10% strength combat bonus. So again, back to domination. And then third, another downloadable content, which is Korea and their Scholars of the Jade Hall. I realize it's the newest downloadable content, and we're often like, ooh, new, shiny, greatest, best ever. But I do think that it will stand the test of time with plus two science for all specialists and for all great percentile improvements and receiving a tech boost each time a scientific building or wonder is built in the Korean capital. Wow. Especially, again, in the early to mid-game.
Benefits right at the start are also really magnified because of how the game works with increasing. It's kind of like a ball rolling down a hill. You know, the old cartoon snowball that gets huge. When you get something really early on like that, it's rather huge in Civ games.
Exponential, yep.
A 500 gold bonus. If you start next to a natural wonder in Spain, you basically won the game because 500 gold buy you an extra worker, get you a monument, which dramatically increases culture rate. I mean, there's just,
I buy you a settler.
Yeah.
Go take some of that land, beat somebody there, beat the AI there. Whew. We could be on this podcast for many an hour, talking about the different rankings. But I'm curious what people's top three are. And I say top three because if you think about, you know, okay, who does the bronze go to? Who does the silver go to? And who does the gold go to?
Yeah, I can't really disagree with your choices. I don't like Spain at number one. I don't like ones that are, you can go the whole game without getting it, or at least getting it at an opportune time. You know, you don't start next to that wonder, and Spain's ability just disappears for a while. But they're good enough that they're definitely up in the top. They're definitely not in England. I like Egypt a lot myself, just the extra building of the wonders. Again, can catapult you quickly.
One that was underrated in the forum poll is Rome's. Rome's ability has actually become more powerful over the past year because other production modifiers like workshops and factories and stuff have been reducing and flat rates of production have been increasing, which makes Rome's ability proportionally better and better. I think that the 25% bonus is now one of the best in the game, when it used to be sort of not particularly good.
Yeah, definitely. Being able to pump out your cities, your other cities, after you build up your capital like that, you can really, really get them out quickly. But again, I'm usually buying, after I found a city, buying a couple improvements right off the top as well.
It's a big bonus now.
Yes, and I've got right now, when the game came out, I definitely would have put Rome in the bottom half, and now I have it smack dab in the middle. In other words, I've got 12 above, and I've got 12 below it. The fact that it's for buildings, I'm thinking about, okay, especially in the early to mid-game, and I know you're talking even more about in the mid towards, the later game when you're starting to get, well, I actually mentioned workshops, that's still kind of early to mid-game. But anyway, am I really going to want to be putting a lot of these buildings in most cities or every city that I do have, but because of the modification that you said that we've lost some of those modifiers and then the base has gotten the increase there, that's why I have moved Rome up, but I do think it right in the middle of things. And perhaps that also is I also base that on my victory goal emphasis.
Ideally, everything would be in the middle. That's something that I've tried to work towards in my own projects is, you know, there's clearly some outliers in this game. I mean, what would you rate as the worst of the traits?
I don't, in the poll, the worst that the Ottoman bonus was listed.
Harbor, great Corsairs.
Yes. I listed that as second last. I didn't do that, you know, just to be controversial, but that's always a bonus. I actually listed America's Manifest Destiny at the end.
No way. You gotta be kidding me. Worse than Barbary Corsairs? That's a joke. I'll be controversial, too. There's no way!
The site bonus is quite useful. I think something that would be a little bit more useful for America is if there was somewhat more synergy between their various different things. The extremely late game bombers can be useful, but it comes so late that it doesn't really have much of an impact on a game overall. And the trait itself, I think it would be more fun, this goes back into the excitement part I was talking about, if it affected all land units. So that, like, your settlers, you could send settlers out undefended because there wouldn't, you could see the barbarians coming. It'd be very easy to spot them with the 3-tile distance sight range. So that might be a little bit more enjoyable and more interesting and more powerful.
If that change was made, I would move Manifest Destiny out of the bottom spot instantly.
It's not in the bottom spot. You gotta be kidding me.
No, I'm not kidding.
Can see that extra range. It often makes the difference between losing or keeping a unit, like often. So I can't justify ranking it at the bottom. Okay, it's not a great thing. And by the way, Imogen was telling me about some interesting bulb paths that you could very quickly reach bombers in this game because of the way the tech tree is set up. So that's also something to be of use. But I think the big thing about the American Minuteman is just that you can upgrade it into other things, and fairly cheaply, I might add. Unlike previous games, upgrades in this game are fairly viable, rather than just being, you know, extremely niche situations. But no, there's nothing about America is great in Civ 5, although this is probably the best form of America we've ever seen in a Civ game, because America in previous titles has just been awful. So now we have some things that are legitimately useful and usable in a typical game, potentially. Which,
well, except for Civ 2, where everyone was identical.
Well, okay. I guess that goes without saying, but fair enough.
Well, just to emphasize that, yes, I was treating these unique abilities on their own in a vacuum, which I know is artificial, because I wasn't taking into account any of the unique buildings and or unique units, which, even though it's in a vacuum, it actually made it a little easier to rank, even though it is skewed, as we kind of said. In other words, just from unique ability, fine, we can debate the merits about, you know, all land military units have plus one sight, and I get that. And then, of course, the other part about the Manifest Destiny is 50% discount when purchasing tiles. Oh, I mean, that's situational. Sometimes it's like, hey, I'm right beside you. I'm going to, you know, take that from you by purchasing it outright. But that's, oh, wow, that's just awful.
Tell purchasing
overall. No, you're
going
to take the ability to get galleys? I mean, come on.
Tile purchasing overall isn't particularly good. One that is, I think, bad mostly because there are some gameplay issues with it is the Great War Path, the Iroquois trait that allows you to move, like, roads through forests. The thing about that is that when you're moving road to forest versus forest to road, it sometimes doesn't operate as a road properly, and so you almost never can get that bonus because you're usually crossing various different types of terrain. And, like, if you move from a road onto a forested hill, then it'll stop your unit completely. And it's just, it would be really great if it actually did what it said it does. And if everything connected up properly.
Yeah, you really need some unbroken forest for that even to be useful.
Yeah. It's just not, I find that one of the worst in its current state because it almost never works.
Well, okay, so assuming it does work, then how does that impact the rank? Because I should even take that. Now that I think about it, I never really realized how that was not working properly in practice. But at least as it is outlined, would that still leave it in the bottom half for you, or would that move it to the top half?
Well, the thing is, in theory, it would be quite good because you're not only getting more gold than, say, the Arabian trait gives by not having to build roads.
Right, because you get a train road, yes. Yeah.
And your workers can move across forests to improve things more quickly, whereas normally they have to move it one tile per turn. So that can speed up your early improvement rate quite a bit. I think one thing that would be good to add to it is to allow either early units or, say, melee units or something to move at normal speed through forests even outside of your territory. So not at road speed, but, in other words, getting the woodsman promotion right off the bat. That might make it somewhat more interesting, because it feels sort of weird that you can move so fast through friendly territory, but then you take one step outside and you get stopped dead. You'd think that the Iroquois would be good at moving through forests anywhere they are. Not quite as good, but that's my thought on it, at least. I've always really liked the concept of the Iroquois Civ, but I think it just isn't implemented very well.
So I mentioned before about it having to be fun, abilities. I'd like the Aztec sacrificial captives. It just seems like a bit of a role play sort of civ, you know, to get in and, you know, sort of counterintuitive that basically going to war gives you culture. I think that's a fun one to play around with. How useful it is or not, I'm not entirely sure, but it's a fun one to play with.
I agree. I rank that sixth.
I think it's a lot of fun. See, that's one of the situations where the excitement and realism of a trait can have a big impact, because, I mean, like you said, Aztec sacrificial captives is a big part of the culture.
Especially with the Aztecs and their ability anyway to gain culture from killing barbarians, and then you go down the honor path, and plus 10 culture here, plus 12 culture there, oh my goodness sakes.
The interesting thing about the Aztecs is it's a sort of overall civ. It's sort of a jack-of-all-trades that can pursue a flexible range of strategies compared to some civs that are more, say, military-focused like Japan.
Hmm.
Right, the Japan units fight as though they were at full strength, even when damaged. Even though I am looking at a domination victory, I've been back and forth on this particular one. Seeing how domination isn't my total, not only is it my total emphasis, but I looked at my criteria. It was my second to last one, actually. And so, with some regret, and some people are probably going to go, what? Out of the 25, I actually have that at 18.
I agree about that, because I generally fight with my units at or near full strength, so it almost never provides me any benefit.
Now, if we got rid of that insta-heal capability, which we've talked about on the show before, I might want to go and reevaluate that. I mean, I use that even less now than I used to, because you talk about, you know, the different combination of units being considerable, but, you know, not just going in with all melee or with all mounted units. What other civilizations' abilities strike our fancy as either best or worst here? We can jump all over the place.
One good example of the generality criteria I mentioned earlier, so that civs are useful for a wide variety of purposes, is Sun Never Sets and the English as a whole. When you have a civ that is the best possible civ to choose on archipelago maps, and is only really good on archipelago maps, then you don't really have any choice at all. I mean, it's the best one there, it's the only one there, it's just, I don't find that very enjoyable.
Yeah, the versatility is very limited. I had that at number 20 out of 25.
I agree.
I think you can see some continents, games, and whatnot as well.
Some, but it's just, it's very focused on a particular map type. I think one thing that would help England a lot is to somewhat reduce the extreme focus on naval warfare.
Fine with them the way they are. I think that Navy has been de-emphasized by the community too much in every Civ. It's important in Civ games, and it should be important. It's a good percentage of the map is water, and if they are handled well, they can be threatening, even devastating. In pretty much every Civ game I've played, the naval units can be some utility on the majority of map scripts.
The thing about ships is that there's no terrain involved, so it's relatively flat. They can't capture cities. You can't bring along great generals or such. The number of ships we have available are very limited until the late game. You only have one ship for each eros, and it's just that if naval warfare were better, I think England would be a lot more fun.
Single player, of course, because in multiplayer, well, that changes a lot.
That's true.
Well, it's not like you can't win at sea, though, in single player, and having an advantage is useful, but there's not as much tactical usefulness at sea. I was pretty sure you could embark a great general, though, and keep him with the Navy. And
you can, but it doesn't provide a bonus.
No, it doesn't.
No.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. Any naval unit with a bombardment could easily flatline a city and let a land unit capture it.
point to be made that is not intuitively obvious about the Sun Never Sets bonus is that it does not only affect ships. It also improves embarked units, which means that since embarked units can move at 4 tiles across water and only 2 across land, or even 1 if it's rough terrain, you can move much faster at sea with embarked units than you can on land, as England.
Yeah.
Well, I think England would benefit from actually just the description changing, because plus 2 movement for all naval units, to me that implies a naval unit is a ship.
Sea domain.
That's not what it says. It says naval units. Is it an embarked unit, not a naval unit while it's in the water?
Well, it's still a land domain unit. It's just embarked. So, yeah, I agree that the description is sort of vague.
It could be reasonably interpreted either way.
Yeah.
But when we think about, like, mounted units, melee units, naval units, okay. Because if your land-based unit on the water could actually do anything other than the fact that it's barked.
Call it units at sea and have done. There we go.
Yeah.
Yeah, what about China?
Yeah, I was sort of surprised it got rated so low on these polls.
I'm a big fan of China. Again, I guess the great general ability.
The great thing about the great general ability is that it works through all eras for all types of units, no matter what your army composition is. Very generalist. It can be useful for applied to a wide variety of military strategies.
When it actually came to ranking China, from its unique ability perspective, Art of War China, Great General Combat Bonus increased by 15%, and their spawn rate is increased by 50%. I put it in the in the bottom half, number 23. And I guess the reason I did that is because I think about half of what that is, the benefit, is that their spawn rate is increased by 50%. Well, if I start thinking about if I want an early great general, for example, honor, warrior code, social policy. If I don't want to do that, and I just want to go and start attacking units, not actually be in active war, then I'm going after barbarians, for example, and I'm going to get that spawn relatively quickly. And that 15%, when we're talking about, you know, earlier-based units, I think that's actually more advantageous later when you get, you know, like an absolute value, like if a combat value, you know, was 10, for example, then, hey, plus 15%, that's 1.5, maybe that runs up to 2. But if the combat value is, you know, it's like a 3, 4, 5, or 6, then the 15% as a percentage just doesn't have the same impact. When I'm looking at this from early to mid-game, it just doesn't call me, even as someone looking towards domination.
You could use Spear Great Generals for Golden Ages, though.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, basically what I look at is extra Golden Ages, which are useful. Really, though, with that trait, I do agree that I mostly focus on the bonus. And if you think about it, a 15% extra combat bonus is almost like a free promotion for all your units, because most of the promotions are in the 15, 20, 25% range. It can be useful, especially in the early game, because when there's not many promotions yet, since the bonuses in Civ are additive, an extra 15% is much more useful in the early game than it is in the late game.
The problem is the diminishing returns of subsequent Golden Ages from your great person, where it gets down to a 3-turn Golden Age. 6, 5, 4, and then 3. And actually, in the later game, I think that is more powerful, actually, to have a great general use for a Golden Age, because those 3 turns, you can get quite a bang for the buck once you have your economic infrastructure established, plus the fact that all the great generals that you actually want to keep on the map, you probably have already. But when I also think about the other unique abilities of civilization's bonuses that are also gold-related and science, production, and culture, too, so, you know, not just treating it in itself as a vacuum, as a trait itself, but what I could have otherwise, I still can't justify it not being in the bottom half.
Well, you know, like mentioned at the start, it's perfectly okay for some of the traits to be less powerful than others, if it's made up for with other things, such as Choconers.
It's plus the generals, their synergy.
Yeah, works out well together. And yeah, that's also ties in with the synergy criteria about how if the various different aspects of a civilization work well together, then that makes a lot of sense.
Arabia and trade caravans, plus 1 gold from each connected trade route, and oil resources provide double quantity. Okay, that's nice, double quantity oil resources later game, you know, that can be nice, but in the early to mid game, plus 1 gold for each connected trade route, especially after the nerfing that was the trading post. Oh, man. Top half, absolutely. I have it at number 8.
The thing about the extra oil is that it's sort of useless because resources are so incredibly abundant in vanilla, and oil and aluminum are sort of arranged strangely in the late game. I mean, it sort of makes sense historically what uses oil and what uses high-tech resources, but I don't think it really flows too well for gameplay.
Yeah, definitely I agree. I rarely find myself running out of any resources, if I got any, in my territories, that is.
Well, one trait I also like is the Siam trait of the father governs children. So I like playing either a diplomatic or a culture game. I think there's a lot of synergy there. If you were going for domination, which I don't often do, it's not so good. But in terms of the sort of game that I like to play, I think that's a helpful one. You know, maybe not as good as Persia, but it's a nice trait to play with.
Oh, Siam used to be, before the change in the maritime city-states, absolutely devastating.
One thing that could help with that is if it's a little bit more versatile, it's strange that it doesn't have a militaristic bonus there.
Mm-hmm.
I found that sort of odd. Ancient Regime, that's the French one. This is one trait that I actually really like because it's so unique to get two culture in all your initial cities. And it's not a free monument either, so it's culture above and beyond whatever else you'd normally have. It's can be very exciting gameplay. It's very different from what you can get through most other sources, other than, of course, the Liberty Tree, and it stacks with that, so it's even better there. I think it's a very interesting trade overall. I'm surprised it got rated somewhat lowly.
Man, when, you know, land is power for most of what you're, you know, what you're going for. Plus two culture per turn from cities before discovering steam power, and steam power is, you know, definitely now getting into the mid to late game. Man, I rank this as number 4.
Yeah.
This is amazing in single player or even in multiplayer, actually. If I see someone that's in multiplayer and they're choosing France, I just think, oh, come on.
I agree.
I think the thing is, it's versatile. You can use it for whatever that culture, for what, you know, whatever purposes you want to. It works with any victory condition. You can go down whatever tree you want to. Extra culture, you know, gives you extra, you know, abilities, you know, puts you further down the game.
It meets a lot of the criteria. It's early in the game. It's versatile. It's pretty fun. It sort of fits. You know, the theme of France is a cultural sieve. Really works well. The next one on is Germany. We talked about that. What about a Hellenic League?
Well, similar to a father governs children of Siam, before what they did to maritime city-states, I was really into going, you know, allying myself with city-states. That as well as for culture, too. But I've de-emphasized a lot of that. Hellenic League, Greece, of course, city-state influence degrading at half and recovers at twice the normal rate. I have it as kind of the bottom of the best. I actually have that ranked as 12 out of 25 because, to me, depending upon the circumstance, you know, if you don't have any city-states near you, it's like, oh, man. Or if you do have them, but they're not that many, or it's, you know, I'm really trying to go for a culture game here. You know, I really like a cultural city-state, you know, to help, you know, get that culture boost early on, but the only city-state that near me is a militaristic one. I think it's just, so it's kind of like if it's there and you're willing to spend the gold on that, but then I think about what I could be spending the gold on otherwise, and often, again, I'm looking for at domination. It's just better to be, okay, I'm going to save some of this gold, and I'm going to continue to produce these, you know, quote-unquote cheap units like warriors, and then I'm going to get the iron hooked up, and even after the iron is hooked up, I can, you know, still be building warriors for a little while, and I'll go ahead and I will, you know, I will upgrade them, and then I will dominate, and I will take more cities that will then get me some additional culture, or allow me to produce more militaristic units, or get more cities that allow for, you know, greater population and greater production, etc. So
yeah.
I think you could really go either way. I think it can complement a lot of your victory conditions and what you're going for, but I don't think it's often going to dominate what it is that you are going to do.
I think one of the things with both of those traits is that city-states just need to be reworked a bit. They need to be balanced among one another, and also made balanced between that and other options on how to spend your gold. I think one thing that might be fun with Hellenic League, because it's Greece, they're militaristic, and it's all Athens and Sparta, and Sparta was a militaristic city-state. It'd be fun if, like, the units gifted from militaristic city-states to Greece started with morale promotion or something that gave it sort of, you know, an incentive to go specifically for that type and have more powerful units from them.
Yeah, something I do feel compelled to do because you mentioned the name Sparta!
You know, I wouldn't mind seeing Greece militarizing city-states they allied with.
Yeah, you know, something focused along those lines.
You know, get an ally with a maritime city-state and it becomes a militaristic one as well.
That could be pretty cool, too.
Double up?
Yeah. Because I don't think an extra unit here and there is really that game-breaking.
Yeah.
Not at all.
So then maybe still with the standard civilizations. Oh, gosh, I know I have an irrational, in part, hate for this, but India, population growth, unhappiness from number of cities doubled, unhappiness from number of citizens halved. Oh, man, I just can't like this. I can't do it. I like my wide empire.
Yeah.
I know there are advantages to tall empires, especially with a cultural victory, which I've yet to achieve in Civilization V. I have to put this in the bottom half 19, but of all of my rankings, I admit there's an irrational bias behind this, but I can't get past it, especially when I consider what else is available.
I think one thing that could help with that is if both of the bonuses were lowered. So let's say, like, gave a 25% reduction or 20% reduction to unhappiness from population, and that's it. Nothing else. Just, you know, flat 20% reduction from population unhappiness.
You know, I see this as my least favorite designed civilization. It's like they created an achievement to win the game with one city, and then built a civilization to give you a way to achieve that. And that's all India was put in the game for.
I think that achievement actually built a very significant myth about Gandhi, is that he's best for tall civilizations. I have had some of my best domination victories as Gandhi, because you end up with so many cities with so much population, that happiness reduction can have a big effect on the game. I mean, I've had domination games where I never even built coliseums in most of my cities because I had like plus 40 happiness from the reduction in happiness from population. The problem is that the per city increase in unhappiness is very, very difficult to get past in the early game when you don't have many sources of happiness and you're trying to expand. It's very difficult early on. But once you get past that, it can actually be a very powerful for conquest victories, counterintuitively.
Siberian riches from Russia. Strategic resources provide plus one production, and horse iron and uranium resources provide double quantity. I used to really love the double quantity thing, and then I realized, you know, Dan, on difficulty levels that you were actually able to get this, you didn't need this. You should have been playing a higher difficulty level, and when I play on that higher difficulty level, I typically find I don't need that much from the strategic resources because I stopped emphasizing melee units especially. And of course, earlier on in the game, when the game was released for, you know, issues identified before, this is really powerful. But now with the balance of having archery units and siege units, the real bonus here, quote unquote, practically speaking, is strategic resources provide plus one production. Yes, that is powerful in the early game, especially with the nerf that has been production. But I still put it as kind of a stronger of the weak ones. I put that at number 16.
Not to mention the fact that strategic resources are so easy to come by. I mean, you found one city and you get six of the resource, and sure, you could build 12 horses, or 12 swordsmen, but you couldn't fit them on the map. Mm-hmm. So I think there's, in vanilla, an overabundance of strategic resources to some extent. And also, as you mentioned, archers. I very strongly feel that archers got overbuffed in the June patch because they both increased the strength of archers and increased the damage per strength point. And the combination of those two, I think, made archers a bit too good. So I agree, Siberian Riches is not particularly good in the current state. But I don't think it's a fault of the trade itself. I think it's other factors in the game that are reducing its value.
I'll agree with that. And then for the standard civ, the last one, Songhai, River Warlord, received triple gold from barbarian encampments and pillaging cities. Embarked units can defend themselves. Okay, to me, receiving the triple gold from barbarian encampments, wow. Anything for the shinies, especially earlier on in the game.
Yes.
Yeah.
When you capture a city, you get some gold, and this triples the amount of gold that you get from capture. So it's phrased strangely. It should be triple gold from capturing cities, not from pillaging cities. Pillaging cities implies, like, if you raise it, but if you raise a city, it doesn't give you any extra gold. So it's another one of those traits that could be reworded for clarity.
Yeah, there do seem to be a few of those.
And then really all we haven't talked about are a few remaining downloadable content ones.
The thing about Mongolian Terror is, again, other issues in the game. You have melee units and archers, so melee and ranged, and then you have melee mounted units, but ranged mounted units don't have their own combat class. The Keshiks and chariot archers and so on should have a mounted archer combat class, because then they could be improved by stables, which would make sense. And the Mongol Terror trait could affect mounted archers and mounted melee. As it is, since it only affects certain types, I mean, it doesn't help against chariots, it doesn't help against some other things. So, not to mention the fact that conquering city-states in vanilla is not really advantageous at all. They're somewhat difficult to capture because they focus more on defenses than other things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not a very well-designed trait. And also the fact that I find combat in Civilization V much too easy, mostly because of limitations of the AI. So I prefer bonuses that improve the rewards from successful combat instead of making that combat easier. So, like, instead of a 30% bonus attacking city-states, instead of it is a 30% bonus to after you've captured it.
Yeah, for me, it's just talking about Mongolia. Yes, the Mongolian Terror, 30%, plus 30% when fighting city-state units or attacking a city-state itself. All mounted units having plus one movement, to me, that is the strength, making it more likely that I'm going to actually build mounted units with Mongolia. And that plus extra movement giving that additional versatility. When I'm looking strictly at unique ability, I'm going to say that, to me, that's one of the stronger of the weaker civs, because of what you can do, and that emphasis as an important can do with mounted units, even though it does take some effort. The fighting city-state thing, it's a great kind of role-play situation. There can definitely be situations where, geez, I'm on a continent all by myself pretty well. There's mostly just city-states around. Why don't I just go and take them? But that's, you know, that would definitely be an exception rather than a quote-unquote rule.
Yeah. And one of the problems with the trait is that how promotions don't work between melee and ranged units when you upgrade. So if you build horsemen, they get advantage from the trait, but then you upgrade the Keshiks and all their promotions are useless, and vice versa. Then you upgrade Keshiks to cavalry and then all their promotions are useless. So the promotions really should be swapped out so that, like, the melee versions are replaced with the ranged versions and so on, so that you have a good continuity there. I think that'd make the trait more useful, because then you'd have this continuity of mountain units from ancient to medieval to class to renaissance and so on.
Question in the chat here. Ranged mounted units don't count as mounted for pikemen, double question mark from Magin.
Ranged mounted units are in the archer combat class. They don't have their own combat class, and so as a result, everything that would have a bonus or penalties against archers also affect chariot archers. And so, no, pikemen do not help against Keshiks, and the stables do not improve the production speed of Keshiks, and so on.
Babylon, ingenuity, receive a great scientist when you discover writing, earn great scientist 50% faster. Yes, please, number 5.
Yeah, that one's been powerful ever since the very beginning.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons I was happy to get the collector's edition, or the digital, whatever it came in.
Of course, that's another situation where the powerful trait is balanced by somewhat weaker other characteristics.
And that just leaves us two downloadable content civs left to go. Phew. The Incan, Great Andean Road, units ignore terrain costs when moving into any tile with hills. No maintenance costs for improvement in hills, half cost everywhere. Oh, man, I think it's easier at first glance to underappreciate this. I definitely rank that in the top half I have that at number 9. I know it can be some situation dependent on the map in terms of, yes, how many hills you have, but half cost elsewhere for improvements.
That's a good one to compare to the Iroquois trait, because the Incan one helps your movement even outside of your own territory, whereas the Iroquois one is only within your own territory. So it's definitely much better than the Iroquois trait in a direct comparison.
And then that leaves us with Polynesia, wayfinding, can embark and move over oceans immediately, plus one sight when embarked, plus 10% combat strength bonus if within two tiles of a Maui statue. So I kind of like Polynesia first, as I was like, ooh, can embark and move over oceans immediately, awesome. Oh, I can build a Maui statue, a specific, you know, terrain improvement unique to the Polynesians, just like the Incans have their terrace farms. But after kind of that initial excitement, I'm just like, wait a minute. Wayfinding, I'm afraid I've got that down in the bottom half at 21 out of 25.
Well, the thing about being able to move across oceans immediately is, since you can contact the other continent, if you have a lot of spare resources in your territory, you can make a colossal amount of gold selling off those resources to everyone on the other continent. Not to mention the fact that you also get earlier opportunities for research agreements, and you can also sell off open borders to these other people who can't even reach you, and all the open borders bring in extra gold. So I've actually found that can be a significant source of gold if you're playing on a continent's map when the continents normally couldn't reach one another. It is somewhat situational, though.
Oh, yes. And absolutely, going back to my criteria about land-based and then land-heavy map type. But if you've got lots of water, and as you said, those that are really heavy on the ocean, you have a significant advantage through that contact and the research agreements and the open borders, and also just knowing where people are, generally speaking.
Yeah. Also because you can get first dibs on a lot of the ancient ruins that spawn on isolated areas such as islands and such, and so you get extra bonuses through those.
And then we've got the Viking Terror. Embarked units have plus one movement and pay just one movement point to move from sea to land. Melee units pay no movement point cost to pillage. Comparable arguments, again, to what's been discussed in the combination of other civs. So I rank that just underneath Polynesia, so Viking Terror at 22.
One thing, and the advantage of that, is that it does have some active use things. I mean, for example, the easier pillaging. Perhaps if pillaging were better. The amphibious movement isn't particularly useful, though.
So is there anything about any of the civilizations that we explored, all 25 to date, about their unique ability that we wanted to add?
We didn't discuss the random civilization. That's a very important one for some people. King Dice III of randomness.
Oh, yes, that's right. We forgot about its unique ability, which is having all of these unique abilities and none at the same time.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 441-221-288-7659. That's 441-221-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Okay, so thank you everyone for listening to episode 136 of Polycast with regular co-hosts Dan.
When responding to life's many challenges, be certain you're answering the right question. What would Sid do?
Yes. And Philip.
Hey, I have a sickness, and the only thing that you're at is Sid.
Joined by guest co-hosts of myself, Zelasicus, and Ben Collins.
Have a good night.
And Jay Bond.
Bye now.
Take care, everyone.
Record date November 26, 2011. Civilization 4, 5, and World Sound Clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive.
Thank you all for being here, even though we had so much less estrogen than usual. Oh, Phil, we didn't sing. What's up with that?
Oh, I'm too busy ranking of unique abilities.
We should have ranked the abilities and sung the rankings. Oh, how did I think of this now?
Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.